All right, everybody, just for the record, 18th of September 2002, Donald Rumsfeld to the House Armed Services Committee, quote, Saddam has amassed large clandestine stocks of biological weapons, including anthrax and botulism toxin and possibly smallpox. His regime has amassed large clandestine stockpiles of chemical weapons, including VX and sarin and mustard gas. He has at this moment stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons. January 20th, 2003, Rumsfeld declares, quote, Saddam Hussein possesses chemical and biological weapons. His regime is paying a high price to pursue weapons of mass destruction, giving up billions of dollars in oil revenue. His regime has large, unaccounted for stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons, including VX, sarin, cyclosarin, mustard gas, anthrax, botulism, and possibly smallpox. He has an active program to acquire and develop nuclear weapons. 11 days into the war, on ABC News, when asked if he was surprised that American forces had not yet found any weapons of mass destruction, he said, quote, The area in the south and west and the north that coalition forces control is substantial. It happens not to be the area where weapons of mass destruction were dispersed. We know where they are. They're in the area around Tikrit and Baghdad and east, west, south, and north somewhat. On January 29, 2003, Pentagon news conference, Rumsfeld claimed that, quote, the Iraqi regime has not accounted for some 38,000 liters of botulism toxin, 500 tons of sarin, mustard gas, VX nerve agent, and upwards of 30,000 munitions capable of delivering chemical weapons. And in regards to Iraq's ties to al-Qaeda, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld told the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce in September 27th, 2003, that the Bush administration had, quote, bulletproof evidence of such ties. And now, last Thursday's confrontation between former CIA analyst Ray McGovern and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld.
Why did you lie to get us into a war that was not necessary and that has caused these kinds of casualties? Why?
Well, first of all, I haven't lied. I did not lie then. Colin Powell didn't lie. He spent weeks and weeks with the Central Intelligence Agency people and prepared a presentation that I know he believed was accurate. And he presented that to the United Nations. The president spent weeks and weeks with the Central Intelligence people. And he went to the American people and made a presentation. I'm not in the intelligence business. They gave the world their honest opinion. It appears that there were not weapons of mass destruction there.
You said you knew where they were.
I did not. I said I knew where suspect sites were, and we were just...
You said you knew where they were, near Tikrit, near Baghdad, and northeast, south, and west of there. Those are your words.
My words were that... No. Wait a minute. Let him stay 1 second. Just a second.
This is America, huh?
Yeah. You're getting plenty of play, sir.
I just like an honest answer.
I'm giving it to you.
We're talking about lies and your allegation that there was bulletproof evidence of ties between al-Qaeda and Iraq. Was that a lie, or were you misled?
Zarqawi was in Baghdad during the pre-war period. That is a fact.
Zarqawi? He was in the north of Iraq in a place where Saddam Hussein had no rule.
He was also in Baghdad.
Yeah, when he needed to go to the hospital. Come on, these people aren't idiots. They know the story.
You are... Let me give you an example. It's easy for you to make a charge, but why do you think that the men and women in uniform, every day when they came out of Kuwait and went into Iraq, put on chemical weapon protective suits because they liked the style? They honestly believed that there were chemical weapons. Saddam Hussein had used chemical weapons on his own people previously. He'd used them on his neighbor, the Iranians, and they believed he had those weapons. We believed he had those weapons.
That's what we call a non sequitur. It doesn't matter what the troops believe.
I think
what you believe.
I think, Mr. Secretary, the debate is over. We have other questions.
Okay.
Courtesy to the audience.
All right, everybody. It's May 9th, 2006. I am Scott Horton, and I'm on the phone with former CIA analyst Ray McGovern. He was an analyst at the CIA for 27 years, even was the morning briefer for Vice President George H.W. Bush in the 1980s. And he is one of America's foremost champions in the fight against the war party. He writes for TomPaine.com, and of course we also reprint his articles at antiwar.com. Great to talk with you again, Ray.
Good to be with you, Scott.
So you made quite a bit of news last Thursday with your confrontation with Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld in Atlanta, Georgia. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah, it was one of those serendipitous things. I happened to be in Atlanta to receive an award from the ACLU for, they call it their National Civil Liberties Award for 06. And I was really happy about that. Last year's award winner was Coretta Scott King. And so I felt very honored. And then when I heard that Don Rumsfeld was coming, I said, well, isn't that nice? I never expected him to come to my award dinner, and but then I realized that probably wasn't why he was coming. And when I found out he was giving a speech, I said, since I'm in town, and since I could never get near Don Rumsfeld anywhere around Washington, maybe I'd see if I can get a ticket to go to that speech. And through an application of some tradecraft techniques that I learned during my career, it happened to be possible to get a ticket to the speech. And,
was that a wig and a fake mustache?
No, it wasn't that difficult. It's just that when you went on the website of this center, the Southern Center for International Policy, there was nothing at all about Rumsfeld coming. And someone said later that the Defense Department had insisted that they take it off the website and keep it off, lest unsavory folks show up. And so it took a little doing to find out which website would be possible to process my request for a ticket.
And when it came to the question and answer period, you asked Donald Rumsfeld why he lied us into war in Iraq.
Yeah, it was not quite so bald and was carried out, having accused Rumsfeld of lies and lies and lies. He sort of sanctimoniously said, oh, lie, why? You know, people accuse the president of lying all the time, and of course, she hadn't accused the president, she accused Rumsfeld of it. Basically, on the president, it's so destructive of the trust that needs to exist for effective government to persist. It's just wrong and bad. And I looked at him and I said, wow, I've seen a lot of cynicism and hypocrisy in my days in government, but wow. And so I had been preparing. I had three speeches to give in Atlanta, and I had been preparing things about Iraq as well as Iran. And it fell out of my little bundle of papers, this quotation from Rumsfeld way back in 2002, to the effect that the evidence of ties between al-Qaeda and Iraq was, in Rumsfeld's words, bulletproof. Now, bulletproof is pretty definitive. And I've always wondered, since the CIA was saying there was no evidence at all, and since General Scowcroft, who was then head of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board, since he was saying the evidence was, quote, scant, end quote, what possessed Don Rumsfeld to call this evidence bulletproof? And so I thought maybe I'd ask him that, because this was a very, very key part of the PR campaign before the war. You see, what happened was there was a very clever decision made after 9/11 to deliberately link Saddam Hussein with 9/11. And so the way they did that was claim falsely that there were known ties between al-Qaeda and Iraq. There were known ties, but they insisted there were. The administration did.
Well, and so, on the eve of war, 70% of the American people believed that Saddam had actually been in on the plot.
That's exactly right. And so it was a cleverly contrived and very effective stratagem. That was all based on a lie. And so I thought I'd just call the Secretary of Defense on that lie and mention in passing that the 9/11 Commission had put this whole canard to bed, saying that there were, you know, really no meaningful ties between Iraq and al-Qaeda. So I asked him about that. And he sort of, kind of dodged it. And I said, look, was it a lie or were you misled? And again, he sort of said, well, Zarqawi was in Baghdad. Now, for people who haven't followed this closely, they wouldn't know that, A, Zarqawi had nothing to do with Saddam Hussein, because Saddam Hussein didn't even control that part of the country. He wasn't in Baghdad normally. He was way up in the northeast. And number two, Zarqawi had no real contacts with al-Qaeda either. It's only the last couple of years that he sort of adopted al-Qaeda as his umbrella organization. So the fact that he was in northern Iraq meant nothing. So then Rumsfeld says, yeah, but he was in Baghdad. And I explained to the audience that, yeah, he was in Baghdad because he got sick and he needed hospital treatment in Baghdad. And up in that northeastern corner of Iraq is no place to be if you need to be in a hospital.
But is that even true? Wasn't the story about him going to the hospital part of the administration's lie that he had had a leg amputated? And
yeah,
we know now that that story is not true at all.
The leg amputated was not true, but he did have some sort of other disease. And the best information I have was that he did wind up in an Iraq hospital. So, but, you know, all this is obfuscation. All this is more smoke and mirrors. And so I thought that the audience ought to know that this is all disingenuous and that, that you know, he's playing us for fools. Now, the audience is really very interesting. They were applauding everything that Rumsfeld said. They were very, very angry that I asked him direct questions. And when I finally said, look, can you tell us why you lied to get us into a war that was not necessary and just produce such terrible casualties? He responded by saying, first of all, I didn't lie then. And everybody just clapped and clapped and clapped, you know. It was almost like there were cue cards there, you know, that they would clap when he said he didn't lie. So,
yeah, they didn't even really wait for a real response. They just, as soon as he said, oh, I didn't lie, they just clapped at that part before he even got to any actual substance at all.
Yeah, it was really unsettling because they didn't seem to be interested in the facts. They just seemed to be eager to applaud the defense secretary. It reminded me very much of films I've seen of Nuremberg in the 30s there in Germany where there were these rallies, you know, and when the Gauleiter or the Fuhrer or whoever said something, everybody sort of clapped on cue. And, of course, there was no dissent there. So that was very distressing, that part of it.
In fact, on the Crooks and Liars video, it shows that the man who asked the question after you began with basically man-crush praise of Rumsfeld and his passion for life. And it was really kind of backwards, it would seem, for the Secretary of War.
Yeah. Well, luckily, I have a strong stomach, so I didn't get physically sick then, but I was mentally sick when that softball question came out, and he said, my mom was a school teacher, and my dad read a lot of history, and that's why I'm so smart. You know, it was a little bit sickening.
Well, and It should be brought up, I think, here, Ray, that there's supposedly new evidence that has come out that the National Intelligence Director has turned over to the war bloggers, and they're sifting through all these boxes of evidence looking for ties between Iraq and Al-Qaeda, and they've come out with new evidence that they say ties Saddam Hussein's government to al-Zarqawi, but Juan Cole has already gone and translated the Arabic for us and says this is an APB. This is a, hey, if anybody sees this guy, you know, his real name is Zarqawi, arrest him. That was an order that was given out from Saddam Hussein. And then also I wanted to note that Newsweek on June 25th, 2003, which just coincidentally is the 13th anniversary of April Glaspie's meeting with Saddam Hussein, they said in that Newsweek that senior U.S. officials admitted that there was no proof of any Saddam Hussein tie to al-Zarqawi. And they also said that again Newsweek on October 26th, 2005. Jim Mikleshevsky, who was the NBC, or I believe still is, the NBC Defense Department correspondent for years and years, he reported in a story on March 2nd, 2004, all about Zarqawi's base in the north and how the military had asked for permission to go in there and get these guys, at the al-Tawid terrorist group of Zarqawi's, and that, according to Jim Mikleshevsky's sources, the White House and the Pentagon denied them permission to go because they needed him there as an excuse for the war. And now look at how many I don't know, hundreds of thousands of people have been killed by Zarqawi since the invasion.
Mm-hmm. It's all pretty cynical. It was quite amazing when Rumsfeld decided to broaden out the conversation and talk about weapons of mass destruction. And he sort of winced, and then he said, you know, apparently there were no weapons of mass destruction. And at that point, I thought that I ought to remind him, and I said, well, no, sir, you said you knew where they were. You know, you said you knew where they are, and he said, no, I didn't say that. I said there were some suspect sites. And I said, no, sir, here are your words. They are near Tikrit in Baghdad, and north, south, east, west there. And he said, no, I didn't, whatever he said at that point. I guess he was telling the folks there not to carry me away, because that would have been a PR debacle of major proportions. So then it's just really kind of interesting. Everybody was clapping when he would say whatever it was, however inane, and they were booing me, saying, sit down, get that guy out of here.
Well, and you put him right in his place, really. What he tried to say was, well, listen, let me tell you that all those army soldiers who invaded Iraq weren't wearing mop gear because it was in style, and everybody clapped, as you say, like Nazi Germany, praising their glorious leader, and then you reminded him that, yeah, but they were listening to you. You're the Secretary of Defense. So what? So you lied to us and you lied to the soldiers and told them there were chemical weapons.
Yeah, that was the hang of it, and that was when that particular questioning was called the halt to by the Peter Smith, by the president of that center.
If I can change the subject a little bit here, I know that you worked for the Central Intelligence Agency for almost three decades, and I wonder if I can get a comment on the appointment of Michael Hayden, Air Force General, to become the new director of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is a very sad development for me. Here's a man who, up until just a couple of years ago, had a brilliant reputation. He's an Air Force officer. I was an Army officer. We both swore to protect and defend the Constitution. We both had ingrained in us at very early parts of our training that we were never to obey an unlawful order. When Hayden became head of the National Security Agency, he made quite a name for himself because he was pretty popular, and he stressed above all else the 11th commandment up there at NSA, and that 11th commandment is, thou shalt not eavesdrop on Americans, period. Now, 9/11 comes, and you've heard it said 100 times, everything changed. Okay, so what changed here? Well, Cheney invited Hayden to come to his office and said, look, we want to institute a eavesdropping program which will enable us to use to full advantage our supercomputers. And we're going to be gathering up lots of signals and conversations and so forth, and there'll be Americans that we will monitor. So we would like you to dream up this program and make sure we get it technically polished and that you implement it. Now, Hayden knew better than anyone else in the whole world that there is such a thing as the Surveillance Intelligence Act, 1978, the FISA, Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. And that act prohibits intercepting conversations involving Americans unless a court order is obtained. Very, very stringent. Now, people can do whatever they want for 72 hours, but then the court has to authorize it. So what Hayden should have said, of course, was, Mr. Vice President, I, with all due respect, I realize this to be an illegal order, since you've told me that you're not going to seek a court order or a warrant, and so you can transfer me if you wish, but I will not obey that unlawful order. That would have been what he should have done. That is what would have kept the morale up in NSA, and it's at real low levels now. But instead, he let himself be seduced, and that's the right word. When you are near to absolute power, you can be seduced. And we have Dick Cheney, and we also have, in this case, General Hayden being seduced into violating the law, violating their own oath to defend the Constitution of the United States, and going back on their fervent pledge when they became an Air Force officer not to obey unlawful orders. So now this is the fellow that they're going to pick to direct the CIA. This is the fellow that will do what he's told, even though it be illegal. In the wake of kidnapping, torture, keeping people incognito, and a whole list of other war crimes, this is the person that we want to put in that position who will salute smartly and do whatever the president tells him to do? I don't think so.
What does this mean in terms of the struggle that's been going on between the CIA and the Pentagon? Seymour Hersh wrote last year an article called The Coming Wars, What the Pentagon Can Now Do in Secret, where he talked about how more and more of the CIA's covert operations role has been taken over by the military.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are said to be troops inside Iran as we speak. Those troops, according to my best information, are Defense Department troops. In other words, they're ordered by Donald Rumsfeld. This is bizarre. Its purpose is to circumvent any oversight responsibilities by the Central Intelligence or by the Congress, and so the Air Force, Army, the Armed Services can do pretty much what they want. They don't have to go to the intelligence committees, and that's what's going on. So, in answer to your question, the military is dominant. The military has always wanted to be dominant, but there were safeguards in the past which would strengthen the civilian arm of things in such a way as to make it honest again.
So do you think the appointment of Hayden then is a score in that battle?
Well, it's certainly not a step in the right direction. In other words, he is military. Worse still, he doesn't know anything about the greatest need the agency has, and that is how to recruit, train, and employ human sources, human agents, spies. He didn't know anything about that. All he knows about is technical collection, the kind that NSA does. So I think he's the wrong person for the job here, and was only picked because he'll do what the president tells him to do. And how do they know that? Well, they know that because when they asked him to violate the law by devising this this program that they now call this Terrorist Surveillance Act, Terrorist Surveillance Program, if you can believe that, then, you know, he's regarded as in pretty good order, and he'll do fine.
Did you see the article in this morning's Washington Post by Walter Pincus about the counterintelligence field activity? It's this CIFA, this division of the military. You talk about them taking over covert actions overseas. Apparently, they've taken over covert surveillance of the of people inside the United States as well.
Yeah. You know, this wouldn't be so bad if it didn't all happen before. I mean, this happened, see, 70s, so this happened over 30 years ago. And that's precisely why we have a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. 1978 was finally put all together. And what it did was two things. One, it forbade government to intercept messages without a warrant. And number two, it let government do whatever it damn well pleased for 72 hours so without a warrant in case there were any urgency to it. So the argument that things are so urgent that they couldn't do their job by following the law, that's not really obtaining here. The other part of your question had to do with covert action, I guess, and the Army and Navy Air Force doing more of it than the CIA. This has always been a battle, and I have less problems with the Defense Department taking this over because it's all commanded by the same person, and that person now is Don Rumsfeld, and whatever he says goes. You know, whoever is the head of the CIA simply salutes and says, "Yes, sir."
Do you have any insider information as to the real reason for Porter Goss leaving? It seems half the story is that there was a turf battle between him and John Negroponte, Mr. Death Squad. And then there's a whole other set of rumors that say he's tied in with the hookers and nefarious goings-on with Jack Abramoff and friends at the Watergate Hotel. Do you know anything about this?
Oh, you mean the poker and the cigars and the hookers?
Yeah.
No, it was just the poker and cigars is all that Fogo was interested in. He assures us he wasn't interested in the prostitutes. No, this is, you know, kind of a really sort of Keystone Cop sort of thing. Dusty Fogo, or Kyle Fogo, was a non-intelligence professional who Porter Goss brought in together with the other Gosslings, so-called, who didn't know a thing about intelligence, but were put in very high positions. And so it's not surprising that we should find out that there were meetings between Duke Cunningham and these folks, including prostitutes and so forth. And whether Tennant was connected with that or not, I mean, he's a pretty old guy, but I guess there's no fool like an old fool. I don't know, and I don't care. All I know is that he left the agency a shambles. He got it in pretty bad shape, but he made it considerably worse in a record period of time. He lost 300 years of expertise on the operations side. You know, I think that the Negroponte and the president maybe even became aware of all that. So this guy's a disaster. And when they asked him to leave, he breathed a sigh of relief because he wanted to leave anyway. He wanted to retire 4 years ago. And someone persuaded him to stay on in the house. And then when he was going to retire 2 years ago, they said, "Oh, why don't you take this job as head of the agency?" So it was a disaster. I think he's glad to be home. It's less stress. You know, he was used to leaving Washington Thursday noontime, going down to Florida, and then coming back on Monday or Tuesday noontime. He had a pretty nice week, you know. You act dignified and important in Washington, and you go back and lie on the beach. That's the kind of life that he was used to. He publicly complained about all the hard work that he had to do when he took over as head of the CIA. With him, you know, he's a classic example of, maybe I'm reflecting my proletarian background here, but he was a rich kid. He never had to make a living. Led a very brief, undistinguished career in the CIA. He and they had enough money to buy himself a congressional spot there, and been pretty happy not doing much of anything ever since. If we ask why the intelligence community is a shambles, well, Porter Goss has as much to do with that as anyone else, since he was head of the House Intelligence Committee during some very crucial years when the CIA went down in free fall. And of course, he tried to complete the job when he became director. So, for Porter Goss, good riddance. It's too bad he didn't leave earlier. Whoever comes and takes his place is going to have a mammoth job, much, much more complicated than it would have been if Goss were a better manager.
You mentioned briefly when we were talking about the Pentagon taking over covert operations that there are said to be already Army soldiers inside Iran. There have been, I guess, all sorts of rumors being published here and there about perhaps full-scale airstrikes against that country before the November elections or right after. Are you afraid that we are really at the brink of expanding this war in the Middle East, or do you think this is just a lot of hot air and saber rattling?
Well, I'm very afraid, Scott. Look at the parallels to Iraq. The same things are being said. It's really quite striking. The only thing that's a little bit different is that John Negroponte, I gather to his credit, is not simply reciting all the things that the White House tells him to recite. He has taken to publishing these sections of this memorandum that talks about the Iranians not having weapons of mass destruction for a very long time, like mid next decade or so. And so if that's the case, then the question is, well, why would we attack Iran? Well, as you know, the new guidance suggests that we don't have to wait for an imminent threat. No. If we see some threats that looks like are coming up, we can preempt them or prevent them. This is not legal under international law, but hey, you know, we're not known to respect a lot of international law. So this is the kind of reasoning. We'll just do what we want, and we don't want anybody fooling around with our constitutional prerogatives as we see them.
Yeah, constitutional ones, and then the president declaring war and fighting it, too, whenever he feels like it.
Yeah, you see, people are saying that the president will be reluctant to go to Congress to get approval for a war against Iran. Now, I may be completely off base here, but my suspicion is that the president would avoid, like the plague, going to Congress, because they know there's no good reason for a war against Iran. So what they would do is just go ahead and cruise missile and bomb the hell out of the suspected nuclear sites and hope that there'd be a fait accompli and people would greet us with open arms and cut flowers, and there'd be just as rosy a picture as Iraq.
I can't wait. Well, I'll tell you, I'll give you a chance to end this interview on a little bit better note. Your article about Mary McCarthy, you make a very eloquent case for whistleblowers ignoring the usual chain of complaint and going ahead and coming public and telling the American people what they know. And I figure I'd just go ahead and give you a chance to say that out loud to wrap this up.
Sure. Well, Mary McCarthy, of course, denies that she leaked anything to Dana Priest on the secret prisons abroad. But the question really needs to be put to Americans. Would you have preferred not to know about these black holes abroad? People are being kidnapped and tortured and held incommunicado there for the duration of the new war? Or did you want to know about that? Because somebody took it into his head or her head that goes to the heart of our democracy, and then we should know about that. And that's why they leaked. And when I say they, I say advisedly. It looks like Dana Priest had over 10 sources for that story. So they leaked the story in the hopes of calling attention to what was going on, and I think that's an act of patriotism. We really need to just keep making sure that the American people have some oxygen. And so somebody famous once said that the oxygen of democracy is the truth, information. And so if we can't tell the American people that people are preparing a war on a major country like Iran, then it's, we've come to a sorry pass. And if we veteran intelligence professionals with sanity are intimidated into not speaking out, well, there we have the sort of creeping fascism right there, when Americans can't find a way to speak out or to find a decent medium, a decent part of the media to speak out on such things.
And if you were still working for the CIA, would you risk prison to violate your secrecy agreement in order to prevent this next war?
Well, you know, that's a good way to put it, but it's not the way I look at it. In other words, what we have here is a conflict of different legal obligations. As an Army officer and as a CIA analyst, I took an oath, the same oath, to defend and protect the Constitution of the United States. As an Army officer, like General Hayden, it was ingrained in me that I must never obey an unlawful order, nor should I order anyone to do something unlawful. Okay, so those are the two basic things. Now, if you learn of crimes of the nature that we've now known about, the kidnapping and rendition and torture and imprisonment without any notification, you become aware of that. The post-World War II Nuremberg Tribunal said that you are required to make that information available and do all you can to prevent it from continuing. These are, by any definition, war crimes, okay? So you have your constitutional duty by virtue of your oath to uphold the Constitution, and you have the Nuremberg obligation, and then, of course, you have the Geneva Conventions and other laws. For instance, the FISA law that I mentioned before that prohibits unmarked wiretapping. So what happens when someone in the course of her or his normal duties finds out that this is going on? Well, international law says he or she must take steps to stop it to the point of their power, and that being unsuccessful, they need to call attention to it because it's a War Crime Act. And so in that kind of context, if we start talking about secrecy oaths, these are documents that every applicant or every actual hiree, right before you come on duty, you're asked to sign, and it says, I won't willingly or consciously divulge any intelligence information that's classified. And that's fair enough. I have never done so. And so you used to be able to sign that in good conscience. However, now it's different. Now we have competing obligations because when we learn of torture, when we learn of kidnapping, when we learn of lies to the Congress, we have a transcendent, a dominant obligation to make those known and to make sure they stop. And those obligations, in my view, dwarf any vestigial obligations under the secrecy oath, because they pertain to domestic and foreign law and really trump the secrecy oath thing. So what I've been suggesting to new applicants is that they follow the president's example and append a signing statement. The president's very adroit with these signing statements. When John McCain's amendment passed, the one that prohibited torture by anybody, including the CIA, the president simply signed it and then put a little note on saying, this shall not be construed as impinging upon my duties as commander-in-chief. In other words, I can do what I want still. There's a stick in your eye. So what the new applicants or the new hirees need to do is add a signing statement that says, in addition to insisting that I will not release classified information, None of the above shall be construed as impinging upon my duty under national and international law to call attention to war crimes. Period. So, what would that do? That would make public the dilemma that one would face and codify and have people sign on to a transcendent obligation to expose war crimes, crimes against humanity, that would supersede any obligation that you would have by virtue of your signature on a promise to reveal classified information.
Sounds like a good idea to me.
I don't think it's going to fly, but I think it sort of speaks volumes that it should be necessary.
Ray McGovern, 27-year veteran analyst at the Central Intelligence Agency. Thank you very much for your time today, sir.
Okay, Scott. Nice to be with you.